Welcome to Spark Your Fire Podcast. Content discussed on this podcast is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals. Now, let's start with the quote of the week.
The most difficult thing is the decision to act. The rest is merely tenacity. The fears are paper tigers. You can do anything you decide to do. You can act to change and control your life. And the procedure, the process, is its own reward.
G'day everyone, welcome back to another episode of Spark Your Fire. It's Friday wrap, as always, we're doing here. Unfortunately, this week we are missing our usual crew, Jazz, again. His family situation is still not getting better at the moment, so we're missing him, that's for sure. But I'm sure he'll be back with us from next week onwards. So this week I've got John here with me. You know, John, we've got lots to cover, but we're going to have to hold our fort without Jazz, mate.
I think we'll survive, but we do miss him. It's good to be back, David. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to have you on as always. So interesting week. I don't know. It's been multiple sides of things. You know, got the US election that's still. As at the time of recording, it's still a bit of a cliffhanger right now. Anything can happen, like we've been saying before podcast. You know, anyone who thought they were on the lead could have a final reversal. Who knows? So, I haven't. I mean, to be honest, I haven't been following as closely as I should in terms of a US election. I reckon you're a lot closer. What are your thoughts at the moment in terms of seeing all that news?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I see what I read in the papers and see in the news. So, yeah. You know, as it stands at the moment, it's like Friday morning now, I suppose.
Yeah.
Australia time. And Trump just had a press conference saying that he will essentially escalate this and take legal action. And his claims are that and I think they're valid, and we can maybe talk about this, because the media are portraying this as some sort of crazy paranoia, but I'm not sure that it is. He's saying that they stopped counting on the night, which is true, and it's highly irregular. They stopped counting on the night in the key battlefield states, and they stopped counting at a time when Trump was way ahead in the on-day in-person voting. They stopped voting, and when they resumed voting, boxes of mail-in votes came in after hours, allowed to come in, and they were almost exclusively Biden votes. And the question is, it's highly irregular, and is this essentially election fraud? Now, on this podcast, we suggested that was a very strong possibility that this sort of thing might happen. We said I think the three of us said that Trump would win, but we also said that there was a very strong chance that the mail-in votes, the Democrats were strongly encouraged to do, might sway the election, but they would also be tainted with suspicion. So that's kind of where we're at. Now, if the voting is all... Now, there are a chance for count every vote, which sounds very nice, and Trump's side are saying count every legal vote, which is... you know, they're both things are fair to say. But if the voting continues and every vote is counted, Biden would likely win, and the betting odds are suggesting that Biden will win. The question is, has this been free and fair? And we'll find out. But we won't know this week. We probably won't know next week. And it's highly kind of unsettling and disturbing, I think.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Totally. But the funny thing is, even though as unsettling as it is, the Dow Jones and the S&Ps are rallying like crazy, like there's no tomorrow.
Yeah. the markets were rallying a week ago on the promise of stimulus.
Yes.
But if you've got a kind of governance in paralysis, that means you're not going to get any stimulus done, and yet it's rallying on that as well. Maybe they like the idea of, you know, the government staying out of it. It's actually very strange how the markets are reacting, but they're melting up.
That's what I find as well. I mean, you know, just during I would have thought that investor confidence during this uncertainty time would be a bit swayed, and they would kind of sit, you know, sit back and look and watch a bit further before making actions. But it sounds like, for the last 2 days, I think it was S&P 500, I think, had one of the best days the day before. And that's what confuses me a bit. And as you pointed out as well, and I think we also mentioned before on this podcast when we casually talked about the election results, is that it may take a while for that final result to reveal, and this is exactly where we're going if Trump's managed to basically get every vote to be recounted, every legal vote to be recounted. That is, it's going to take a while. Basically, and we like we said, 2020 is a year of uncertainty, and it certainly hasn't let us down until last minute.
I mean, you're right. We talked on this podcast that there's like one last twist waiting for us. 2020 is not done with us yet, and you know, this might be it. It's crazy. We can talk about the markets more, but politics is always dangerous on these podcasts, but I think it's highly relevant if we're investors. Mm. I'm actually quite sympathetic to the concern of the Trump team, because if you're getting boxes of late mailing votes,
yep,
where they're not allowing people to check the signatures and so on, it's statistically impossible that Biden could get 100% of these votes. It's just statistically impossible. Now the problem is, when I was watching the press conference, when it would cut back to the commentators, they would say, well, Trump hasn't given any evidence, and of course he can't yet. What he's saying is we're going to challenge it in the court, and it's highly irregular, and I think that's okay for now. They will need to present some evidence, and that's going to be hard too.
Challenging, isn't it? But certainly, from the argument that you presented, certainly those mailing votes, and that's where Trump and his supporters are currently drilling on, right? Like, as you pointed out, how likely is it that the statistics of such having boxes and boxes of mailing votes coming in and it's all 100% to Biden? That's, when you think about it logically, not saying that Trump is absolutely right here, but he's definitely got his doubts and suspicions to say, well, hang on a sec, what's going on here? There seems to be something that's behind the scenes. So, interesting times, mate. I don't know how it's going to pan out, but I'm sure there will be further media coverages as we progress along next week. But at this point in time, question for you, if Biden does win and becomes the next president of the United States, how would that impact investors in general?
The thinking over the last month or so has been that if Biden wins, there's going to be more stimulus, and it would be positive for stocks. It would be positive for anything that goes into renewable energy, so things like silver, nickel, those sorts of things. So silver had a big run last night, up about 5%, so those sorts of things would respond to a Biden win. The only, we mentioned this last week, but the only curveball is that Biden is planning to significantly raise capital gains taxes. So if he were, but then it comes back to what can he achieve? Now, the Republicans did quite well in the House and they held their majority in the Senate.
Yep.
So he probably can't get any of these things through.
Correct.
So that calms the market down. So the market likes that. They like government in a kind of a straitjacket, so they can't get anything done. I think that what will happen is the big tax reforms probably won't go through, but I think that the stimulus packages will go through because they will get bipartisan support. So we'll probably get the stimulus without the tax increases.
That's a good point, because I was thinking about, any kind of, it's just like here, right? Like any kind of decision needs to pass both the House of Representatives and the Senate to a degree. But, they're saying, I think I saw an article yesterday that talks about at the current rate of how the seats are being allocated between Democrats and Republicans, even with Biden does become the president, it's going to be challenging to get anything across or anything to pass based on the current allocations. Because it's almost like 50-50. at the moment, right? Like, you know, you got 50% of people supporting Biden, you got 50% of people supporting Trump to a certain degree. And there's no clear winners here. So, you know, Biden wanting to push any things through, it's going to get a lot of resistance, obviously from the Republicans on that perspective. So, it will be interesting. I don't know how it's going, and maybe it will put US into more of a stagnation instead of anything for the next couple of years, despite the fact that Biden's obviously wanting to make changes and wanting to do the best for US, but the other side of the party doesn't see it that way. So yeah.
I was speaking to a friend who lives in Pennsylvania, and he's a Republican that voted for Biden. And he did that because he didn't like Trump. Totally understand that. But what he kept saying was that he just wanted things to go back to normal. You know, he wanted peace, and that things have been absolutely crazy the last 4 years, and they indeed have. So I think there's a sort of a sentiment in the US that they just want this crazy year, but this sort of crazy 4 years to come to an end. I've got sympathy for that as well.
I tend to agree. I think Biden coming from a more of a, you know, he used to be the vice president, right? So, you know, he would play more of a regular and try to get the nation back to more of a stable and get the whole world's economy into more of a stable state, and then in comparison to how Trump would do it in that sense. So hopefully we'll see some normality if Biden does get elected, and how that will impact the markets, I guess we'll have to see.
I mean, my view is that Trump actually governed as like a moderate Democrat, almost certainly a moderate Republican. He wasn't outlandish on policy. On policy, he was very moderate. He had tariffs, which I didn't like. He had tax cuts, which I did like. You know, so there was a mix. And on policy, he was very, very moderate. In terms of kind of tone, that's where he rubbed people up the wrong way.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, and that was very understandable as well. But I think the way he governed was quite moderate, except the tone wasn't. He had a very adversarial approach, way about him. And look, the base really liked that, because they think that, you know, the Republicans put up choir boys every 4 years, that they put Mitt Romney and John McCain and these guys who take defeat very well-mannered. And what they liked about Trump was that he was going to be a fighter. The problem is the nation was so highly strung. It was a ball of stress and tension, because everything was a big fight. So some people liked it and some people didn't, but it's been almost stressful. So we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens.
That's right. To be continued, I guess, is essentially what we'll say here. And I guess there'll be more results, more news coming rolling in next week. So let's sit back and watch to see what's going to happen and how that's going to impact the rest of the markets as well. Okay, so that's US election. Let's talk a bit about local stuff then. So RBA made the announcement of cutting the cash rate this month on Melbourne Cup Day, bring it down to historical new low of 0.1. So that's another 15 basis point drop. At this point in time, unfortunately, all the banks, major banks, have not actually passed in any of that. They've kept all the variable rates the same. So they have not decided to pass on anything to consumers, which is being slammed and being hammered by basically the industry. Because what's the point of RBA dropping their cash rate when the banks do not follow? The end consumer, unfortunately, does not get any benefit out of that. And there's a few aspects, I guess, we look at that, I guess. If you look at it from the perspective of banks' profitability from, you know, in terms of what they have released this week and last week. So ANZ's dropped 40% year on year in terms of their profit, mainly because of all that preparation fee for any kind of upcoming bad debt, right? People unable to make repayments and all that kind of stuff. So they're reserving a big chunk of cash just in case those bad debt does go sour. And with that, you know, they're looking at a 40% year-on-year drop at the moment. So that's a big hit in terms of a major bank like ANZ. Westpac has announced earlier this week it's a 66% drop. Again, similar story. You know, they are racking up a big chunk of money in preparation for the upcoming bad debts for repayment. So 66% is where they're standing, and NAB is a 47% drop as well. So they're all staggering. You know, they're staggering figures when you think about it. And when you've got these type of profitability drops and the uncertainty in front of us for the next few years, of course, from economic perspective, from unemployment perspective, it is challenging for them to be able to, I guess, maintain a balance between passing on what they can pass on versus, you know, how much profit they still need to maintain in order to keep the business running to a degree. So I don't know, John, in honesty, I actually wasn't surprised that the banks have not passed on any of the variable rates. I mean, a lot of customers have asked me, I said, look, my expectation is they're probably not going to pass it, to be honest, because the rates at the moment that the consumers are enjoying is already low. It's very, very low from a historical perspective. And, you know, the chances are they're not going to do it. And this is exactly what we're seeing right now. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree that it was a bit of a gift to the banks. Yeah. So consumers have benefited for all the rate cuts up until now. And I think this is just to increase the spread of the banks so that they can have some padding for, you know, these big profit downgrades that they've taken. I mean, as you say, it's all for reserves for doubtful debts. I was surprised they did it. We chatted about this last week, and I think 2 weeks ago we kind of said, yep, they'll cut. And then you stuck with that and you were right. Last week I was saying, I don't think they'll do it based on what the ANZ chief said. But I was wrong. It was a gift to the banks. But look, where I kind of line up on this is that firstly, it is good for real estate. If you're a real estate investor, there's just like a boiling cauldron underneath the asset values, and it's about to run if it hasn't already in some respects. Second thing is lower interest rates don't really help the real economy. The reason for that is that ultimately cutting interest rates makes society poorer, makes your economy worse. And the reason for that is that, economies grow because we consume and invest some, but we also save some, a part of what we produce. And up until the 1970s, the US saved more than all other countries combined. They had very high savings rates. And this was the balance in their economy while America was becoming very wealthy. So they were the biggest savers on the planet. The reason why lowering interest rates makes you poorer is because it plays a trick in the mind of your economy, of your society. All the asset values go up, but it's just inflation. And what ends up happening is that you end up consuming against what you think is an increase in your wealth. So if you imagine it's like a redraw on your house that you use for consumption, but the economy is doing this everywhere. The whole economy thinks it's in, you know, the value of its economy is inflating, and that you're consuming against that perceived higher value. But actually, the value of the economy is not going up. It's just inflation. And then what happens is what the Austrian economists call you're consuming your capital. So instead of just taking the fruit off the tree, you're cutting the tree down and you don't even know it. You're taking the branches off. So because you're consuming capital rather than consuming the fruit off the tree, you lower interest rates makes you poorer. So that's kind of, but I think we're in what we broadly call a crack up boom. It's what happens at the end of a monetary experiment when all asset prices go vertical and when everyone in the market realizes that there's a concerted effort to debase the currency and it lasts a couple of years and everything goes up, but that's actually because people are just trying to get out of holding dollars. Mm. So that's kind of what I think is happening. But
I tend to agree with you. I tend to agree with you. I think it's that wealth effect that they want to make people feel, because as we all know, psychologically thinking, we go, you know, John, our houses have just gone up 10%. You know, you're more likely to spend rather than, you know, contract and save, right? So there's certainly that effect that RBA wants to make homeowners in particular, property asset owners, to say, you know, hey, you're actually getting richer, you're getting wealthier, therefore we need you to spend more in order to reignite the economy, to for it to go back up as normal. So So, in essence, what you're saying is, you know, like, you like, it's a great analogy, by the way, you're not eating the fruits, you're actually cutting down the tree. From a longer term perspective, this is not great from an economical perspective at all. So, and I reckon in a few years' time, when we look back, I reckon we can be pretty confident in terms of seeing that, okay, well, was it actually a right decision to make at that point in time? But, you know, it was an experiment. Like you said, it was a monetary experiment, right? And without going into all the modern monetary theory, the MMTs, which I know Jazz has already interviewed a lot of economists that talks about the MMT. So we're not going to go into that. But yeah, I think looking back in a few years' time, there will be a lot of lessons that we can learn out of this COVID period, that's for sure, you know, including whether RBA, whether dropping it down to 0.1 is actually really a good decision or not.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, you know, they'll lower interest rates and then simultaneously they will acknowledge complaints why, you know, young people can't get into the property market. Well, they can't get into the property market because every time there's an economic problem, you lower rates. That's the, like, when all you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So, fine, lower interest rates, but don't complain about income inequality and don't complain about housing unaffordability. That's
you can't have everything. You can't have everything in the world, right? There's got to be some sacrifices somewhere. But, you know, yes, it is difficult for millennials to save up for a deposit, but at the same time, government's also giving out incentives and making sure there's schemes in place, in particular the first homeowners type of things, right, to help them get into that space. So, and I personally know a lot of millennial clients that they have done really, really well by purchasing properties and, you know, accumulating assets. So, it just comes down to a psychology and a mindset type of thing rather than just sit back and complain and say, oh, you know, I lost my job, I can't do anything. You know, get up and do something about it, take action. So have a come up with a saving plan, all that kind of stuff to be able to get ahead of the race, which is how it currently works, basically.
100%. No, you're 100% right. There's always a way.
Yeah.
Just
whether people are doing it or not. Okay, great. Now, apart from the rate reduction, the cash rate reduction, RBA has also announced a reduction in the target of the yield on the three-year Australian government bond to around 0.1%. So in other words, they're lowering the yield for 3 years government bond to 0.1 and also reducing the term funding facility. So this is the money that the RBA is providing to the banks. The reduction in the interest rate on new drawings under the TFF to 0.1%. So beforehand, it was like, you know, banks borrowing 0.25% money from RBA. Now it's down to 0.1% from TFF. So it's even cheaper money for the banks. And that's why, that explains why they're able to pass on the fixed rate reductions for a longer period, because we're seeing, like, I think all the major banks are coming up about 1.99% for 4 years fixed rate home loan. The type of stuff. That's how they're able to do it because, RBA is effectively saying in 3 years' time, or we're not going to raise interest rate in 3 years. Who knows? Maybe they will have to slap their own face at some point in time. But at this point in time, that's where they're going to say, you know, the interest rate is going to remain low and it's going to remain low for at least 3 years. Those are actually, and another one, the purchase of $100 billion of government bonds of maturities of around 5 to 10 years over the next 6 months. Now, is that the start of money printing,
John? Oh, it definitely is. Yeah. Look, it just says to me that, you know, it's just giving us an indication of the time frame that we're going to have these policy settings for. So it's sort of saying it'll be like this for at least 3 years.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Okay. Look, I think the positive side is certainly RBA is willing to do whatever it takes to try to get the economy back up as soon as possible and get the unemployment rate down as soon as possible. But the benefits of that rate drop at the moment is yet to be seen. I know the majors came out so far, obviously announcing no change variable. They're reducing the fixed rate. The only second tier lenders that kind of came out so far that say they will pass on the variable rate, so there is one that I'm aware of, is MiBank. They are passing on 0.15 to all the variable rate existing and brand new customers. So, you know, that's obviously good news for those MiBank customers, but not so good news for all the other consumers at the moment, okay? So, But yeah, the general consensus is that unfortunately the most of the lenders have not passed on, except for like the major players. The smaller players like Athena, Ubank, you know, Homestar, that kind of stuff, they have all passed pretty much between 0.1, 0.15 as well. So they're quick to act in this sense. I think that's a fair coverage in terms of the monetary policy decision for November. Is there anything else you'd like to add, John, to that? No? Okay, awesome. All right. The other one I want to cover is in relation to responsible lending changes. Okay, so I think we talked about responsible lending changes a few weeks back when Josh Frydenberg obviously made the announcement to say, look, we're going to scrap responsible lending changes because of the fact that credit's not flowing as fast as we like to. And since the September announcement, the Treasurer has now officially opened for consultation at this point in time in terms of, okay, well, here are the changes that we're proposing to do. And I thought there's a few things that's probably worth just calling out or keeping everyone updated in terms of where we are with that. Now, so first of all, the responsible lending obligations at the moment, the proposed responsible lending changes will apply to only a small amount of credit contracts by ADIs and consumer leases beginning on 1st of March 2021. So in other words, we're looking at a target date of March 2021 at the moment, and the scope of the responsible lending obligations have reduced significantly, basically from all credit contracts now to only a small portion of the credit contract. So that's what they're looking to propose at the moment. They're also imposing some lending standards for non-ADI. So those, what ADI is like major banks, so what they call authorized deposit taking institutions. Whereas the non-ADIs are like the likes of non-banks, you know, the ones that cannot have a savings account, transaction account, that kind of stuff for you. So traditionally, the non-banks were able to kind of get away, use it very loosely, inverted commas, be able to get away from having the same regulatory framework as the major banks. So, you know, they probably don't have the DTI, the debt to income ratio, that that's strangling a lot of investors. But moving forward, one of the proposals is that they want to impose the lending standards for non-ADIs as well, based on similar obligations to those imposed on ADIs. Okay, so they're looking to streamline that process. So that's the second point. Now, they also want to amend the Credit Act to provide Treasury with the power to determine standards specifying requirements for credit licensee systems, policies, processes in relation to certain non-bank credit conduct. So again, this is more applicable to non-banks, reviewing how they're currently giving credits, assessing credits. And last but not least, but looking at extending the best interest duty or the best interest obligations, which is basically currently applicable to only brokers, mortgage brokers, to all credit assistance providers, just to ensure that the appropriate consumer protections remain in place. So the way I read it is best interest duty currently, or will be upon 1st of January 2021, will be applicable to all mortgage brokers to make sure that we act in the best interest of the customers in front of everything else. So, you know, whether that's broker remuneration, so everything needs to be justified and explained to say why we're choosing this product and how it's going to suit the customer best. Beforehand, it was only for mortgages. Now they're looking to expand that to personal loans, any kind of car leases, that kind of stuff. So I think that's what Treasurer is looking to push as well, to allow basically all kind of credit assistance providers to also follow the best interest duty. So that's a first cut of the current responsible lending obligation changes that's currently being released. It's currently opened for consultation for all the industry members at the moment. So and it will be finalized towards the end of November at this point. Okay, so any thoughts, John?
No, I mean, I think that it's going to lead to lots of lending. I mean, if you combine lower interest rates with more available credit, I mean, it's, you know, in a sense, QE is when you replenish bank deposits. Mm. So you give banks lots of money. I guess you can give it to governments as well. And then, if the lending rules mean they can't then lend it out, you don't get the credit expansion get the benefit. That you want. So you need to lend it out. Look, it's a good thing if you're a property investor or a property buyer, or it's even better if you currently own property and you want to refinance.
Yep.
Did I hear you say that it was expected to be in place by March next year?
1st of March 2021 yeah, right. is the current target date.
Okay.
Yeah. So
mark that in your calendars, people.
That's right. Hopefully we'll see some, yeah. But obviously this is the first cut, so we'll expect to see there will be further changes that's along the way and potentially more proposals as well. So, okay, so that was a quick update on the responsible lending up front. And John, would you like to give us an update on property prices, how the capital cities have gone so far?
Yeah, definitely. So this is the first week of the month, which means that we've got data for October. And, you know, we talked about our expectation that real estate prices would bottom in September, which means they kind of needed to, you know, bottom then and go up in October. And any increase in real estate prices in October would be confirmation of the bottom. And I think that the October data, which is now in, confirms that there is essentially a bottom in place, or we're past the bottom. You know, if we look at Sydney, was up, I mean, these are small numbers, but they accumulate. Sydney was up 0.1%.
Yep.
In fact, all of the capital cities were up with the exception of Melbourne. So Sydney was up the least. Sydney was up by 0.1. Brisbane was up by 0.5. This is all for October. Adelaide was up by 1.2%. Perth, 0.6. Hobart, 1%. Darwin 1.2%, Canberra 1%, and these are big numbers outside the big two cities, outside the big three actually. So they're all up around 1% per month. It's staggering if you annualise that. That would be 12% a year, which is certainly possible. So if we go to the last 12 months by capital city, this is, you know, we were chatting before we started the podcast that if you look at the last 12 months, it looks like a normal year. So Sydney is up 6.1% for the last 12 months. That looks like a normal year. It's what Sydney normally does. Melbourne's a bit different. So Melbourne's up by 0.7% over the last 12 months. So that's unusual. Normally it would be about the same as Sydney. Brisbane's up 3.5% over the last 12 months. Adelaide's up 4.4%. The two top performing cities over the last 12 months are Hobart at 6.5% and Canberra at 6.8%. I think it's fair to say that there's definitely a recovery. What we're also seeing is that the volume of sales each week is actually quite high. You know, yep. A couple of months ago, we were talking about a market with no supply and a market where there was nothing to buy. But Sydney auctions are up at about 800 auctions per week. Now, at the peak of a market a couple of years ago, that would be about 1,000. But we're not that far off it, and we're certainly higher than last year. So volumes are up, clearance rates are up, and now prices are up. I think if prices increasing is a good thing, then we're on the cusp of what I think will be a multi-year increase in property prices. We'll wait and see for that. But it's certainly real estate seems to have bottomed, and we'll have to watch what happens next. But yeah, positive. Yeah.
The definitely positive news is, even though Melbourne at the moment from a monthly perspective is still negative, on a weekly perspective, I think all the capital cities now into the positive territory, despite very, very little. So we're talking about 0.1%, 0.2%, and that's a weekly change. But when you know, that's the trend. The trend is certainly moving, that we're moving upwards in that perspective. So, I think... Like we discussed, basically, probably you need to look at it more from a longer term perspective rather than just a shorter term on a month by month. But it's good to be able to get that holistic view, you know, be able to see both from a monthly perspective and also looking at from a holistic 12 months. Okay, well, you know, how did this city perform in respect? And what was the auction clearance rate last weekend for Sydney, John? Was it close to 80% from memory?
Yeah, 79%.
79, yeah.
And look, 78% in Melbourne, and that's really high. So It's definitely a seller's market now. So we've had a sustained period of about 2 months where the clearance rates are over 70%. That usually portends increasing property prices. So we're starting to see that. If it gets into the 80% range and then dropping interest rates, which means that they're not even thinking about increasing them, And if it starts to get above 80%, then you've got booming property markets, not just increasing property markets.
Totally. No, interesting, mate. I think, John Comino, you do call it the right time when we ask you about a few months back about the bottom, isn't it?
well, as they say, you know, if even the sun shines on a dog's bottom every now and then. So I got lucky. I mean, picking the month is one thing, and it's really not, that's not here or there. My big prediction is actually that we have a big boom that goes to mid-decade. That's a bigger call. We'll see. What we're seeing at the moment is houses boom and units are not booming. Mm. So for there to be a broad bull market in real estate, you would need to see units increasing as well. We're not really seeing that. That happens next year. I suspect that they would need to let students back in. Correct. They need to open the borders. So, you know, it's actually quite a narrow real estate upsurge. It's really just houses, but we'll see. We'll see what happens to units next year.
Yeah, it's a bipolar at the moment, isn't it? Like, basically houses and units are going at different speeds. I think when they turn the immigration tap on, when they let the international student coming back, there will be rental demands again. And I think I don't have the data in front of me, but in terms of the construction pipeline, I think it's also at a record low at the moment as well, right? So
That's true. I mean, you raise a really interesting point, and I'll throw it out as a question, but rents, one of the other things that came out of the October data is that rents are falling, which is a factor of, you know, a function of immigration and so on. But let's say you're an investor and you want to buy a unit, and you know that the prices aren't falling for properties, so you want to, you feel like potentially they're going to go up from here. But the rents are falling, so your yield is going to come down and your cash return is going to drop. What do you do? Do you buy now and risk, and not risk, losing out later on when prices increase, but know that your rents are probably going to go down? So what do you do if you're an investor?
That's a great question, John. Look, I think at the end of the day, it just comes down to your own tolerance level, right? Like, are you happy to see that kind of cash flow hit and, you know, be prepared that it could be a good 6 to 12 months away, at least until, you know, the borders open, the people coming back into Australia again? Do you have the capital to be able to hold out to that long? In fact, as a personal, you know, I would probably even look at it even from an 18 months perspective until things are kind of starting to come back into more of a normality from rental perspective. Mm. Yes, you know, there's going to be asset prices increases. However, there's no guarantee. No one can guarantee when that's going to happen. So yeah, it's basically like, yes, it's a great time to be able to buy into units as long as you've got that that buffer in place, that you're able to hold out for potentially up to 18 months and be able to suffer the cash flow in that. From a longer term perspective, we'll definitely reap the reward. That's my personal thoughts. But if you've got, you know, a lot of buyers at the moment are definitely looking at non-investors, really. They've got the need to live in somewhere, so that's why first home buyers are flooding the apartment market, whereas from what I'm hearing, you know, from investor perspective, not so much at the moment. Yep. Just because, you know, they can't see the tunnel at the end of the tunnel, the light at the end of the tunnel about the rental as at this point in time. So, but what would you do, John?
Well, I think it partly depends on what you can refinance at. So if your rents are falling, but let's say you're getting 3% on a unit and you're paying 2.5%, it's like, okay, well, my rents are going down, but my interest expense is going down faster. So I'm not really in that much of a different position than I was a year or two ago when interest rates were higher and rents were higher. So the arbitrage between what you're making is actually greater than it was a couple of years ago. The way I look at when to buy real estate, when to buy is now the right time is such a tough question, right? So let's isolate investors. I think it actually, the when to buy question really doesn't come down to what the market's doing, because your job is to find deals, not to worry about what the market's doing. And that's kind of how Warren Buffett plays it. So, but because real estate is a 30-year proposition, maybe a 50-year proposition, and let's say you've only got the opportunity to buy 3, 4, 5 in your life, you don't have the time to wait for the market to come good. You don't, that's a luxury that you just don't have. the main considerations when you're buying real estate is, what's my income now? Will the bank bank me? And how many properties do I want to own by when? So how much income do I need? They're your considerations. If the yield is 2.7% or 3.1%, isn't how you should be thinking. It should be about what do I want to achieve and what can I achieve based on my income and my lending capacity. And I think that this is where ultimately, if you're a real estate investor, your mortgage broker is your best friend. It all comes down to finance.
Yeah, if you can get the finance, that you can get the property, right? So that's ultimately what it is. But yeah, it raises a great question. Like you said, the residential yield against the actual interest rate that people have been paying has been, that gap has been pretty steady over the last couple of years, right? So you're looking at, from an investor perspective, as long as the return is there and the numbers works out, and you've got the resources to be able to hold on to it for long term, and we're talking about 20, 30, or even 50 years, like you mentioned, then it's worth exploring and making sure that you're achieving, you're moving towards that goal. And also, most people's working life isn't as long as they thought as well. So
that's a really good point. So how many years can you wait it out before you buy property? Because whatever you wait, that's, let's say you wait 2 years or 3 years for the right time of the market, that's 3 years less earning that you have. So that's why I don't think timing in real estate is as important as it is timing buying shares, because the debt makes it just a completely different proposition.
Yeah, 100%. Interesting. I think, nobody can predict the future and nobody knows what's going to go on. But everyone's circumstances is different. So, you know, definitely don't take this as investment advice from both me and John. Speak to your mortgage broker, speak to your team members, you know, your buyer's agent and all that. Just double understanding what resources you have, what can you achieve in the current environment. But, you know, as John said, I think we'll be looking at some very good asset growth on the property side of things, potentially in the next few years. So you want to get yourself ready rather than just keep waiting on the sideline and then missed out another potential growth, good growth for a few years. Anything else to add, John?
No, I mean, it's a big, I've got my popcorn on the stove ready to go and watch election coverage. So
round two.
fascinating time. You know, here we are in November, the year's nearly over. It's been crazy and it's that's not relenting at all. We've got election shenanigans and I'm happy to go back to Middle Earth, to my quiet life, so we'll see, but I think 2020's got a bit more in store for us.
Yeah, and I'm sure when Jazz comes back with us next week, he might be able to throw a bit more some other curveballs. Who knows? Maybe. Okay. Well, I think that's pretty good for another week of Rider Wrap, mate. A lot of moving parts, a lot more exciting things to keep an eye out. But we'll all eyes on the US election next week. So I'm sure we'll have the full team will be able to bring you further updates next week and how that will impact the markets moving forward. Until then, I hope everyone stays safe. COVID numbers are single cases, which is fantastic, across New South Wales and everywhere else. And, I'm seeing, I think there's two more types of doses for vaccine. So on that front, that's certainly positive as well. So 2020, interesting year. Who knows what's going to be happening next week, but, I guess I can't wait for an even bigger 2021. All right, take care, everyone, and we'll see you guys again next week in another episode of Rider Wrap.